this is a quantum gravity class. I got a list of some of you who registered to this class, which is smaller than the, what does this mean? Some of you are will register, will not. I mean, why got a list shorter than, I'm happier that you're more than. Oh, okay. So some of you might continue to follow or might not, is that the thing? Great, okay. So, this is me, and this is the topic. I have decided to postpone to the second lecture some sort of general introduction about quantum gravity, because you probably had it already, and because I don't want to start with a lot of blah, blah, blah. And rather use this first lecture to give you a direct glimpse about quantum gravity. So today, I want to do a calculation and show you sort of the core of the matter. Quantum gravity is about quantum properties of space, quantum properties of gravity, which means quantum properties of space. And I want to show you the quantum properties of space. So we'll do a calculation, which in my opinion is at the core of the story. It's not, of course, the full theory of quantum gravity. I'll write it down later on. But it captures the essence of the thing. So quantum gravity. Now, gravity, because of general relativity, is the same as the geometry of space, right? The core idea or discovery of Einstein is Einstein 1915 is that there's a wonderful description of the gravitational field as the geometry of space. Or if you want, the geometry of space is nothing else than a manifestation of one particular field, which is a gravitational field. So studying the quantum aspect of the gravitational field is study quantum geometry. Or the quantum property of geometry. And so what I'm going to do now is to talk about the quantum property of geometry. And by geometry, I mean the thing that you measure about space. So length, area, volume, angles, areas, volumes, angles, and so on. So I'm going to show you the quantum properties of these objects here. Okay? And if I arrive in 1 hour, we'll just get to the actual calculation of these quantum properties. Now, what does quantum mean? Well, quantum mechanics means sort of two things. One, dynamically in quantum mechanics, instead of having evolution equation, you have an evolution equation for probabilities. So you have probabilities, transition amplitudes, sort of probabilistic probabilities for evolution. So transition amplitude. In quantum mechanics, you compute transition amplitudes. Then the square gives the probability. And so the main object of the course is to write the transition amplitudes for the dynamics of these things here. And we'll get to write explicitly a formula for the transition amplitudes for the geometry. But the other characteristic aspect of quantum mechanics is discretization, right? Quanta. That's why it's called quantum mechanics. Quanta. Somehow, it all started with Planck realizing that to make sense of the black body radiation of this curve that fitted the data then so well, you have to think that the energy comes in quanta, and then Einstein's idea that the light comes in quanta, photons, and then Bohr's idea that the energy levels of the harmonic oscillator is quantized, so quanta, and so on and so forth. So today I focus on this. Okay, so I'll describe to you the quanta of geometry. And that's the aim of quanta of space. That's what we're going to do today. Okay? It's not going to be complicated. I'll start very simply by reminding you some basic elementary quantum mechanics that you probably know very well, and some basically elementary geometry that you also know very well. And then you'll see how they fit together and give the description of the quantum space and a specific prediction about the world, possible prediction about the world, by bringing together the two ideas. So let's start from the first half. So there are two halves, this and this, and then bring them together. Okay. So let me start from the first half. Enormous amount of blackboard, so I can just use it. Let's go here. So quantum mechanics and some reminder of things you know very well. So just a couple of examples. Example one, it's suppose you have a spring and a mass, Km. So you have a harmonic oscillator, okay? Dynamics of a harmonic oscillator, which I'm sure you've studied in all sorts of manners, right? That or a pendulum. So how do you describe this? You have the position of this thing here, Q, which evolves with time. It's a position. You have the velocity. You have equations of motion for this thing here, which you know I'm not writing down. You have the momentum, P. And essentially, you know anything about the dynamics if you know the energy. So the energy is one half mv squared plus one half kq squared, right? The energy is conserved, and of course, in the classical theory, the energy can take any positive value. That's what is going to distinguish it from the quantum theory. So the energy is any non-negative real number, or zero, in fact, also. Good. So this is the classical dynamics of a little oscillating thing. What is quantum mechanics telling us? Well, quantum mechanics is contained in a simple idea, which is the following, you know very well. Now we go to the quantum theory, that there is a Hilbert space of states. It's a space of quantum state, so some linear space with a scalar product, where position and momentum are represented as operators. In fact, self-adjoint operators there. Then there is a story. We know how to use that to compute transition and amplitude and the rest. But the key ansatz, the key point from which everything follows is the idea that these operators don't commute and that QP is IH bar, okay? This is the input that makes the system quantum mechanical. And that is the quantum ansatz, if you want. That's Heisenberg. It's the main, I'll call it quantization ansatz. And of course, in posing this commutation relation, one is adding something which was not at all there in the classical theory and writing down a new law of nature, if you want, some sense. That's what Heisenberg did. And it follows just from that, as you know very well, that there are quanta. Because if you write the energy as a function of these two operators here, so now these are operators, right? As a function of Q and P, just P squared over 2m plus k half Q squared. And you do a little bit of mathematics, which I'm sure you have seen, I'm not going to repeat it, then this is an operator on this Hilbert space. You solve the spectral problem, the eigenvalue problem of this operator here. So I psi some n is equal en psi n. And you discover that the eigenvalues are discrete, so that the energy is not anymore a continuous number, but the energy now has the form h bar omega, n plus 1/2, okay? The energy eigenvalues. So this is the quantization of energy. And is the core number one content of quantum mechanics, the discretization. Right, then there are the probability transition elements, transition amplitude, the probabilities. The reason I'm doing, you know all this very well, of course, but the reason I'm doing it slowly is that I'm going to copy all that for the geometry, right? So I'm just putting the dots where, insisting where the key points are. What does it follow? It follows that the energy comes in level, in levels, and so there are quanta. The system, this oscillator can have one quantum, two quantum, three quanta, right? And these, if you think for a moment, are exactly, if you have the electromagnetic field, you expand it in modes, and mode by mode is an harmonic oscillator. So each mode comes in quanta, and these are the photons. So this is a prediction that there are photons. It's Einstein prediction. The electromagnetic waves comes in particle. They're grains of electromagnetic field, and these are the quanta that come into, if you do this calculation with the right frequency for an electromagnetic wave, you get E equal H nu, Einstein equation for photons. And of course, if you do an analogous calculation for an hydrogen atom, you get the energy level, so you get all of chemistry, the periodic table, and so on and so forth. All this comes from this quantization ansatz here. Now, example number two. Just the same. Just the same, but with a little bit more of structure, which allows me to introduce a few things that I'm going to use for the geometry. Imagine you have a little object that rotates, little ball, little iron spin that spins, that rotates. Then, classically, you can describe it, its rotational motion by the angular momentum. Which is a vector, and since I'm going to use it over and over and again, let me just be careful. I write L1, L2, L3. So Li, for me, I will always take values 1, 2, 3 in some Euclidean space. And of course, the total amount of how much this rotates is L, is the modulus of that. The square root of Li, summed over I. So that's the total angular momentum. Now, this is a classical description of this rotating thing. What about its quantum description? Well, its quantum description follows entirely, again, by assuming that it's a Hilbert space, and that this angular momentum here is in fact an operator, not one operator, three operators, acting on the Hilbert space and satisfying some commutation relations, analogous of that. And the one that works, that in fact you can somehow derive from that in a particular sense, which I'll say in a moment, which are the following, Li, L1, L2 is IH bar L3, and so on, symmetrically, which can be written Li, Lj is IH bar epsilon IJK, Lk, where epsilon is the completely anti-symmetric object, right? It's a thing that is a zero unless IJK are all different, 1, 2, 3, and all different. And the sign is the parity of the permutation, right? So again, this is the quantization ansatz. In fact, historically, it took some time to relate this to the other one. Of course, if you think of the angular momentum L as Q vector P, and you just make a little computation starting from that and this thing here, you get that. Okay, you can do it as just a few lines. Now, so the quantum mechanics of something that rotates is described by Hilbert space and by the set of operators here. Now, why am I introducing that? Because in that particular case, finding out the possible form of this Hilbert space and the operators is particularly easy because there is all the mathematics already worked out, because these things here are the definition of the SU2 algebra. So the three operators L1, L2, and L3, okay, define an algebra, an operator algebra, which is in fact studied by mathematicians enormously and is the SU2 algebra, and which means that we have a Hilbert space which carries a representation, so operators that realize a representation of the SU2 algebra, and these are listed and studied in detail by mathematicians. Here we're physicists, not mathematicians, so every time we can, we take the result of mathematicians and use it directly, okay? So what does a book on the representation theory of SU2 tell us? It tells us that any Hilbert space that carry those operators can be soaked just piling up elementary irreducible representation Hj, where J is a spin, so a half integer, and 2J is in K space of non-negative integer numbers. And on each of these spaces, so there's H0, H1 half, on each of these spaces, there are operators which are well known that realize that. For instance, where J equals zero is trivial because it's all the operators are the identity. But in fact, operators are zero, sorry. But if J is one half, then H one half is just C2. And the L are proportional because, in fact, I'll say this in a moment, H half sigma, if I'm not wrong with the sign, and with sigma as a Pauli matrices. Z. Thanks. Thank you. If you haven't used Pauli matrices, David will tell you everything about them this afternoon and we'll learn all the details about that. So for higher spins, there are other generators of SE2 that are well known and listed. Now, why about the H-bar? Because in fact, the SE2 algebra is this one without H-bar, okay? So these operators here are H-bar times the generators of the SE2 algebra. So it's H time times the generator at 1/2 sigma. Now, it follows immediately from the same mathematics here that the total angular momentum here, which is this object here, so L square, is H bar square. Let me write this explicitly. L is H bar the generators. By J, I call the generators of SE2. J vector J, I use this notation. This is called the Casimir of the SE2 representation, and it has a property which is a multiple of the identity in each one of these spaces here. And it's, in fact, is equal J plus 1 on each Hilbert space times identity. So this is written in the mathematics books. Now, what about the physics? Well, the physics is obvious. if I look at the eigenvalue problems for L square psi equal psi n, L square n psi n, if I look at its eigenvalues, since it's proportional to the identity, these are just eigenvalues. So this means that the angular momentum, the total angular momentum of something that rotates, has necessarily this form here, the square. Okay? So the angular momentum is proportional to h bar jj plus 1. In the case of spin 1/2, 1/2 times 1/2 plus 1 is 3/4. So the angular momentum is proportional to h bar square root of 3 over 2. There's a lot of physics here, obviously. There is no, because these operators don't commute, there is no state in which, there's no state which is at the same time an eigenvector of all three of them, which means that there is no state where the three components of the angular momentum are all well-defined, which means that quantum mechanically, you cannot really think of something that rotates because you never have a vector angular momentum well-defined. You know that at most you can diagonalize two operators together, L square and LZ. So classically, three numbers give the motion of the rotator, quantum mechanically just two numbers, and a third one is fuzzy, is always necessarily fuzzy. So quantum mechanically, you never have really something that rotates, but something that whose angular momentum is fluctuates always. Okay, so this was elementary. I hope you're bored because you know that. Now let's go to the second piece, which is geometry. So geometry. I've been extremely elementary for quantum mechanics. I'll be extremely elementary for geometry. So I want to describe a space, and I don't want to describe a very complicated space. Let me just describe a simple, small bit of space. So space is three-dimensional space, the one in which we live. And imagine you have a small chunk of space. So one chunk of space. Now, if you forget quantum mechanics, this can be arbitrarily small. Of course, it can be a small chunk of space. So let me just imagine it. In one dimension, I could take just an interval of the line. In two dimensions, just a triangle. In three dimensions, I could take a tetrahedron. So let me take a tetrahedron. Okay, and it has six sides, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So if I call, say, 0, 1, 2, 3, I can label the length LAB, where AB here is 0, 2, 3. I can label the six lengths with six numbers. So the shape of a tetrahedron is determined by the six numbers. Okay? Now, these six numbers are a bit ugly because, first of all, they are positive, or zero. More importantly, they cannot be given arbitrarily. Right? I cannot take one length like that, one like that, and one like that to make a triangle. So for each triangle, each of the side has to be shorter than the sum of the other two, shorter of equal. So there are inequality defining the space of the possible lengths that define the shape of a piece of space. So can we give a cleaner description? Of the space of shapes. In principle, the L define everything, right? The space of the L with all these inequalities is well defined, and I can have the area, for instance, of the faces as function of LAB, the volume as function of LAB, and the angles, say the dihedral angle at each side, the angle between the two faces, the side AB, function of LAB. All these are well-defined functions, which you find, which were found by the Greek 27 centuries ago, but they're complicated functions. So can we give a cleaner description? Well, there's one cleaner description, which is the following. Instead of giving the length, let me give three vectors, E1, E2, and E3. So I give E1, E2, E3, three vectors. Now this can be freely assigned, of course. They always define a tetrahedron. Okay, I don't have any funny constraints anymore. I only have to make sure that I'm not over describing it. These were six numbers, six lengths. These are three vectors, so 3 + 3 + 3, there's nine numbers. So there's a redundancy of three real numbers in this description, which correspond to how you rotate the three vectors. Okay? So up to rotations, common rotation in this in the vector index. These describe the geometry of this thing here. In fact, I can do a little bit better because now, you see, zero is treated different than 1, 2, 3. I mean, it's not very symmetric. Can we give a more nice symmetrical description of it? Yes, by defining the following object here. What happens if I if I take E1, vector E2, in fact, let me put a 1/2, and call this L3. What is this object? E1 and E2 are two of the sides of the tetrahedron. The vector product is normal to both of them, so I get something normal to the to the face, to the triangle. right? I get this normal here. So I get a vector normal to the triangle, and such that its length is what? Well, consider the case in which these are orthogonal. Then is the side of one, the side of the length of one, the length of the other, divided by two, which is the area. In fact, you can check this is invariant under linear transformation. You can check that this is always the area of the phase three, naming the phase three is the one opposite to the vertex three. Okay, I can do this for each one of the tetrahedron are four faces, right? For each one of the faces connected to this one, so I can define L A as 1/2 epsilon A B C E B vector E C, okay, where A B C here is 1, 2, 3. Now it's not zero anymore, so forget about that. And what about the fourth phase? Well, the fourth phase is easy to work out. You can do it as an exercise because the fourth phase, the 1, 2, 3 phase, the zero phase here, you can find its normal by taking this vector tensor, this vector, and this vector is just this minus that. Okay, so it's just simple calculation, and you can find it out. And if you do it, you discover very easily that L0 plus L1 plus L2 plus L3 is equal 0. Which, so it's a property that you find in elementary geometry books. If you have a tetrahedron and you take the normal, the four normals to the four faces.
So what's the definition of L0?
Sorry?
What's the definition of L0?
I gave you the geometrical definition. Is the normal to the face, to this face here, the one opposite to zero, with length equal to the area. Okay. If you want, you could take that as a definition, and then you find out that this is nothing else but the normal. Okay. So, if I give these four vectors LF, so F now are the four faces. So let me call them 0, 4, 0, 3, or 1, 4, it doesn't matter. F are the faces, okay? Such that the sum is 0, I have a description of the tetrahedron. I have 9 numbers. Up to rotations of these things are the 6-dimensional space of the tetrahedron. The area of the each face is just the length of each is one. And what about the volume of the tetrahedron? Well, the volume, it's a simple exercise to show that the volume of the tetrahedron is a little number, which in fact is 2/9. Do I have time to compute it? No. Times epsilon A, B, C, L, let me write this one, L1 scalar L2 vector L3. So you take any three faces, you take the triple product of the two, okay? This means 2/9 epsilon ijk li lj lk, 1, 2, 3. And this is 2/9 the volume. You just compute it for a tetrahedron who has three sides which are orthogonal, and then you get the coefficient, and then you think for a moment how it transforms under the linear arbitrary transformation, and you show it has to be that for any arbitrary tetrahedron. So we have these quantities with these conditions that define the area, the volume, and it's also easy to compute the dihedral angles because the dihedral angles are easy to compute in terms of scalar product between two of these. So this gives a nice, clean definition, description of the geometry of a Chankov space. Okay? Good. So far was completely elementary. Now let's go to the heart of the matter. And you can imagine what's going to happen Now look, the geometry, because of Einstein, is a gravitational field. The same thing. So the quantity that gives length, area, to thing is the gravitational field. The gravitational field is like the electromagnetic field, is a quantum field, is a field. Like all fields, it will have quantum properties. So it's going to be a quantum field. So any function of the quantum field is going to be an operator. So length, area, volume are going to be operators. So this object here has to become operators in the quantum gravity theory. Okay? And the volume is going to be an operator, the area is going to be an operator, the angles are going to be operators, so this is a relation between operators, and so on and so forth. So in quantum gravity, now we are in quantum gravity, every time you have a small amount of space, you will have a Hilbert space with operators LF, four operators LF, describing it, satisfy some commutation relation. Which commutation relations? Well, in this particular case, it's going to be simple, right? Everything is variant under rotations. So on this Hilbert space, there should be some action of rotation. So there is an immediate answer that you can think, which is the following, that Li, Lj, for each one of these phases, is I, epsilon I, jk, lk, for the same phase. So let's take this as a quantization ansatz, exactly as we did before. Okay? And one of the things I will show you is that if you start from the action of general relativity and write the metric operator and write its own commutation relation that follows from PQ and the action and so on and so forth, you find exactly this answer here. So this is where you fall. Okay? Now, of course, we need a constant here because this is an area. The dimension of this is an area, right? It's a product of two lengths. This is the dimension of the area. It's the dimension of the area. So here you need something with a constant alpha with the dimension of area, which is going to be something which has h and g, which in fact is an area, is Planck square in the quantum theory. That's going to be the square of the Planck length being of the order 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, so very small. Sorry, alpha is going to be LP. No. L square. This is an area. This is an area. So you need an area here. So, okay. L is a L to the four, length to the four on both sides. Okay? So let's do it. We have to find a Hilbert space where these are represented as operators. But we know it. It's the same as before, right? So immediately, it turns out that the Hilbert space, it's going to be a sum of Hilbert spaces where for each f, you have a spin. So there will be an hj1 tensor hj2, tensor hj3, tensor hj4. So the Hilbert space will be a sum of things labeled by four spins. Not only that, but immediately, okay, remembering what happened with a total angular momentum, the Casimir, so the L square, is going to be quantized in units j, j plus 1. But the Casimir here, the square, is area. So the area of each face, it follows immediately from that, that the area of each face is an operator acting each one on each one individual Hilbert space, okay? And we'll have eigenvalues which are gonna be alpha square root, because it's a square, which is jj plus one. So every time you have a small chunk of spaces, little tetrahedron, with areas, four areas, these areas cannot vary arbitrarily, but can also have, can only have certain values which are given by jj plus one. Okay? Just follows from directly quantum mechanics and the idea that the geometry is given by the gravitational field, which is a quantum thing. What about the volume, which is the most, the interesting thing? Well, the volume is gonna be an operator that acts on here. And it's gonna be more interesting because, of course, the volume, volume is here, right? It has one term that acts on the first, on the second, on the third of the Hilbert spaces. By the way, it's a simple exercise to show that if instead of 1, 2, 3, you write 1, 2, 4, you get exactly the same quantity as before because of this condition here. Okay? So you can take any three faces and write the volume, you get the same quantity. So the volume is going to be 4, 9. I'm going to write in terms of, so this L's here, F, we're going to be alpha times JF, where the JF is the generators of the SU2 representation. So alpha to the third, volume squared. Sorry, something wrong here. This is length square, length square, length square. This is dimensional length 6. This is the volume square. So the volume square, which is the dimensional length to the sixth, is going to be the generator of representation 1, scalar, the generator of the representation 2, the generation representation 3. So let's look at this operator here, what it does. And let me do it in a simple case, because we have less than 15 minutes. I want to show you exactly the eigenvalues of the volume, what they are. So let's choose the case where let's take a chunk of volume such that the area of the each face is as small as possible without being zero. So J1 equal J2 equal J3 equal J4 equal 1/2. Okay? So then the Hilbert space, the Hilbert space is H 1/2 tensor H 1/2, four of them. H 1/2 we said is C2. So these are quantities with two indices, A, A taking values 0 and 1. So it's a complex number with an index, it's a spinor. Right? So inside here, there are quantities which are four spinor indices, A, B, C, D. And J in the representation 1/2, in the representation 1/2, this is 1/2 the Pauli matrices. So I just have to write this operator, three Pauli matrices, one acting on the first index, one acting on the second index, one acting on the third index, and see what it does. But careful, we have forgotten an equation along the way. Which one? One equation which are left following all that. This one. Right, there are not four independent things, there are three independent things. So let's look at this equation and see what it does. Okay. Each L is a generator of rotation. If I sum all of them, what do I get? I get something, let me call just L, total, which is a which is something that generates a rotation in each one of the Hilbert spaces. And it has to be zero. So all the states should be such that the sum of the L acting on the state gives zero. Right? Are you following? But if the generator of the rotation gives zero, it means that they're invariant under this rotation. So this means that in this Hilbert space, in fact, to respect that equation, I have to look only at the subspace, which is invariant under a rotation in each, a common rotation in each one under a rotation on each index. So I only have to look at quantities with four spinor indices, which are invariant under rotations. But again, you look at the mathematical books, and they tell you that there aren't many things which in, with spinor indices which are invariant under rotation. Essentially, there are only two things. One is the epsilon AB, the matrix 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And the other are the Pauli matrices themselves, SA, AB, out of which I can define sigma I, A, sigma, and put the I downstairs. The Pauli matrices with indices upstairs, which is sigma I, AC, epsilon, CB. So the Pauli matrices epsilon are the only invariant things which I can write with four spinor indices. So the only possibility of writing an object with four spinor indices, which is invariant, is to use these two things here. I got linear combination of things with these two things here. So let me do it. This doesn't move. Okay, so let's do it here. Do you see here? Or so what am I doing? I have this space here, H1/2, tensor H1/2, tensor H1/2, 1, 2, 3, tensor H1/2. Okay? And this is H1/2, 1/2, 1/2, 1/2. And I'm looking at another space which is smaller, which I call K1/2, 1/2, 1/2, 1/2, which is the invariant part, under SU2 of all that, of H1/2, tensor H1/2. What's the dimension of this? Well, it's very easy if you have worked with SU2 representations. 1/2, tensor 1/2, is just 0 plus 1, right? Two spinors can give you a scalar. And if I take, so the invariant part of this is this 2. The invariant part of this is again this 2. So this thing here is 0 plus 1 tensor 0 plus 1, right? So this is 0, 0. That's an invariant thing. 0, 1, which is only 1. 1, 0, which is only 1, and then 1, 1. So let me do everything. Plus 1, plus 1. And then 1 is 1, 1 has a 0 part, plus the 1, plus the 2. So the only two invariant pieces of that. The scalar-scalar part of this, the scalar part of this, let me write one vector there. AB, CD, epsilon AB, epsilon CD. This is clearly invariant. And the zero that comes by taking two vectors, that's the only one. AB, CD, is equal sigma ABI, this is the representation one, sigma CDI in the representation one. So these two states here span the physical SU2 invariant part of the Hilbert space that describe all the possible shapes with that given area. Okay? And now it's just a small calculation. I have this volume here where J are sigma matrices. I act on these two vectors, and I necessarily have to get a linear combination of these two vectors. We do it explicitly. Takes 1 second. So V square acting on psi 1 is given by 4 over 9 alpha cube. And then I have some 2 to the 3 because I have 1/2 coming from each. And then epsilon ijk, the sigma I, in fact, it's not the way I'm writing it. Sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. So A, B, C. On the fourth index, nothing happened. D, A prime, B prime, C prime, D prime, acting on this state here, A, B, epsilon, C, D. And this immediate calculation with Pauli matrices, you just get delta. I don't have time. So you get I want to finish in the lecture, so I get to the end of this and I give you and we discuss what it means. This is equal two I alpha psi two. And if you do the same calculation on the other, V squared psi two, you get minus six I alpha psi one. So in this two-dimensional Hilbert space, the operator V square is nothing else than 2IC 0, 1, minus 3, 0. It's a 2x2 matrix that can be diagonalized. And the eigenvalues, you know how to diagonalize a 2x2 matrix. Let me just get to the end. The eigenvalues, B squared plus and minus, turn out to be 4 times 3 times 2IC. Which give you, finally, as believe me, this is just algebra, that the volume itself has an eigenvalue 2 square root of 3, 9. I'm not sure of these numbers, alpha. C, sorry. So the algebra can be worked out. I'm near the end, so I wanna conclude. So what is the point here? The point here is that the volume at the end is a finite dimensional matrix in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, which has eigenvalues which are discrete. And the area of the four faces plus the volume form, in the sense of Dirac, a complete set of commutative observables. They determine uniquely the state. So the states of these things are given by J1, J2, J3, J4, and the volume eigenvalue. Notice that there are four, not five, not six. Sorry, there are five. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, not six. So you cannot fix, you cannot diagonalize the entire geometry of these things together. It's like the angular momentum. So the geometry of these things is necessarily fuzzy at small scale, at that scale there, and is discrete. Of course, if you go to big angular momentum, you can choose an arbitrary good, you can write coherent states where all three components of the angular momentum are arbitrarily well defined. So also here, if you have a tetrahedron large enough, you can have area and volume arbitrarily sharp, provided that you're away from this distance. But if you go in the small, what do you get? You get a picture of space-time where geometry is quantized, which means first that area and volume have discrete spectra, so if you could measure like the angular momentum, if you can measure it, just split discrete values. Second, it's fuzzy, the geometry is fuzzy, because you cannot diagonalize at the same time all the six lengths. There's always some. And third, that an arbitrary state is always a linear superposition. Of the basic states. So in fact, a generic state can be a superposition of different geometries. Okay? So the physical picture we get is a space-time which is discrete into small. It's nothing shorter than a Planck scale. And down there, there's this fuzziness. So this is what all I wanted to say. The full theory put this in the context of a dynamical theory. But I think I wanted to give you the core of what happens in quantum gravity.
So because the volume, the squared operation, product of the operator, which you not compute as we know, V squared itself is not a condition. For example, in that form.
No, sorry, it is V squared is a emission. If I got an I, lambda 1 plus lambda 2 is 0, and lambda 1, lambda 2, just for this matrix here, is 3. So lambda 1 square is minus 3. So there's an I coming from here, and I coming from here. The V square is emission. Everything, all the operators are emission here.
Okay.
In fact, right, this is an emission operator because the eigenvalues of this are imaginary, and there's an I here. I was fast here, sorry, because I wanted to not to continue the next lecture. In fact, you can redo this calculation slower and fix the numbers here and there. The important thing here, of course, is not which particular number is there, but the fact that you get eigenvalues of areas, eigenvalues of volume, and therefore geometry quantized at small scale. Did you follow? This can be redone. In fact, we will redo it with arbitrary polyhedra instead of tetrahedron. And then you get the same thing, but more algebraically more complicated. And writing the volume for a generic polyhedra in terms of the normal of the phase is far more complicated. So in principle, the same thing. In practice, then you don't get a simple matrix to diagonalize. But the result is general. Other questions? Good. So this was very much going into the core. Next lecture, I will put this in context. I'll show you where it comes from. And also, I want to get something out of you in the sense of what you're interested in, what you want. I've given you this this piece of paper. Please write or tell me tomorrow sort of what sort of things would you like from this course, right? So we're here to, I'm here to try to help you at the best to understand quantum gravity, if, what we know and what we don't know quantum gravity. Of course, a lot of we don't know about quantum gravity. So I'm here for doing what you prefer, of course. Okay? Good. See you tomorrow. Oh, wait, no, one question.
The area L here itself is not observable. Just its component and square is observable. Can we require it not Hermitian?
No. The angular momentum itself is observable. Each component of the angular momentum is observable. Each component is an Hermitian operator. The total angular momentum is an Hermitian operator. What you cannot do is observe the component X and the component Y together. It's like P is observable, Q is observable, but you cannot observe P and Q together. But all the quantities I've written here are individually observable, and each quantity is represented by self-adjoint operator.
So the angular momentum itself is also observable.
That's right. We're talking about the angular momentum or in quantum gravity? What's your question? Yes, it is observable. Yeah, when you do a Sten-Gerlach experiment, you're observing one particular with an electron that goes through a magnet. You're measuring one particular component of the angular momentum in one particular direction. So each component is observable. Tomorrow, also, please let me know what was not clear here. I mean, part of this was completely elementary. Part of this was a big jump, right? I'm talking about quantum space, quantum geometry. So please come with questions. Ask me. If you get lost, tell me immediately. I prefer to that we remain in touch. Okay? See you tomorrow.